I got a city report. I went through some of my stuff yesterday and I found in a previous oral history, I had two pages on the Brickham Amendment and then, it's here. And, one of the old Department of Justice memo.
Oh, good, good. Is that the one at Columbia University?
Yeah, you've seen that.
Yes, I have. Let me start this off. This is an interview between Joseph May and Herbert Brown now, November 9th, 1977.
In fact, that was one of the things I wanted to ask them about. They have a restriction that if you are to quote or cite from this, you need written permission.
Yeah.
And there is one particularly good thing that you say in there that is very quotable. And I would, about the importance of the issue, and I particularly would like to quote that if it would be all right with you.
Well, I checked that over yesterday, and it is all right with me to do it.
Okay, yeah. Fine. Well, then if I could get a letter to that effect,
sure,
because it requires writing. Okay, fine.
Do that while you're here.
All right, that's very good. Mr. Brownell, you were right in the middle of the thick of the thing from the beginning to the end. There's so many questions I could ask you, but we only have a limited amount of time, I realize. I have three or four areas I thought I would concentrate on. Just to give you an outline of the whole interview.
Yes.
The first one would be the area of the Nolan substitute, how it came about. Then second, I'd like to ask some things about the negotiations with the Bricker forces in December and January of 1953-54. Then I'd like to, there's some questions I'd like to ask about the emergence of the George substitute and what happened in that respect. Then, if we have time, I'd like to find out why the negotiations in 1955 broke down. I have a good deal of the correspondence on that, but,
we'll have to refresh my record as you ask the questions.
Uh-huh.
So I'll get it in the right chronological order.
And then, if we have time, there's a question about the status of forces agreements that I would like to ask. The problem of reaching an agreement within the administration on that. So that is the general direction I'd like to go. So the first area here on the Nolan substitute, you had meetings with the Republican Policy Committee in the summer of 1953. And, backing up in April when you were testifying before the hearings, you came out against any amendment. Now, between April and the summer, of course, several things happened, one of which was the Judiciary Committee came out with this revised Which Clause version.
Oh, yeah.
And another thing that happened, I gathered, was that it seemed like that the support for the Bricker Amendment was beginning to build up. Now, was the idea for the Nolan substitutes purely an idea to head off the passage of the more serious Which Clause version? Did it come 100% out of the desire to prevent this? Or did President Eisenhower genuinely feel that he wanted? In other words, where did the pressure for the Nolan substitute come from?
Well, as I recall it, the Bricker forces were pretty well convinced that the President would not go along on their original draft, and that so that if they maintained that in the original language, it would not get through the Senate. The President had enough backing to defeat it. So that was the main reason feeling among the Republican senators that they must support John Bricker, who was, you know, personally very popular and had fought hard for this for several years. And I think that he carried some of the senators with him on a personal basis. And so I think the Nolan substitute was probably for a combination of reasons, both of those reasons.
So in part it was a need to keep the party together.
Yes.
For fear of splitting the party at this crucial time when the president's program was before the Congress.
Yes, it was really the first test of the president's strength in foreign affairs. As to whether or not he could keep the party on an internationalist course, which is the reason he ran in the first place. And it was a test with the group in the Senate that was really nationalistic or isolationist or whatever you want to call it.
You know, one of the things I found out that was very interesting, and I got this from Senator Bricker himself. Oh, by the way, I'm sorry I didn't answer the question you you asked earlier when you was meddling and fixing the tape recorder. I am working on a book on this. I'm hoping to get a full manuscript on just on the Bricker Amendment controversy.
Great.
And I have
needs to be done. I'm glad you're doing it.
Senator Bricker has given me access to his papers and several interviews, and I have seen the materials in Eisenhower Library, the Department of Justice papers have been made available to me now, and many other sources which I've collected on this. One of the surprises that came out, and Senator Bricker was the first one to broach it to me, was that in those first 6 months of 1953, Senator Taft, the majority leader, was working to delay the Bricker Amendment. Bricker was surprised to find this out. And I got from several other sources that Taft, behind the scenes, though verbally, was giving support to very mild support in public, was working to delay the thing on the floor. And I wonder if you could...
I think that's correct.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you recall how that was worked out. Was that worked out from the president and Taft, or did you speak to Taft, or...?
No, I think that Taft genuinely wanted to support the president as much as possible, and that he did so in this case. When did he die?
Oh, he died in, I believe it was around June of 53, June or July, somewhere in there, because Nolan was taking over his duties during May.
Yeah.
And,
well, I think if Taft had lived, probably it would have, the Bricker controversy would have died down in the summer of 1953.
Well, I know that Nolan was asked somehow by the administration to introduce the substitute. He didn't write it or compose it himself. It was composed over in the administration.
Yeah.
But I haven't gotten the connecting link of how this was done. Do you recall if you asked Nolan to do it, or if this was done through the White House staff, or...?
I think it was done by a group of senators, Senator Ferguson and Senator Nolan. And they had been... they wanted to prevent a split between Eisenhower and Bricker for partisan reasons, I suppose, largely, and they genuinely felt, as Senator Bricker, that something had to be done along the lines of restricting the treaty-making powers of the president, and they wanted to accomplish that if they could without a split in the party.
And Senator Nolan, probably feeling that he had to represent the administration's point of view, and probably knowing of Senator Taft's...
That's right. He was trying to
trying to
get a genuine compromise on language.
Right, right. Because I think at the beginning, he probably was for the Bricker Amendment, the same as everybody else.
Yeah.
And then, the other group, the regular... the people around Bricker, I don't think it was probably any difference in his thinking. So his thinking had to change as he got into it, too.
True.
But he didn't consult with Bricker on this. This is the thing, because not even a day before the substitute was introduced, Bricker didn't know anything about it.
I think that's correct.
Bricker just took it as simply an administration ploy, a diversionary tactic, I think is what we call it.
Well, I think it was... I think it was the group of senders that really originated that rather than the administration.
That early? Oh.
Yeah.
Well, now that is a new angle.
I can't prove it, but I don't. I think I would have known about it if it was an administration move.
Mm-hmm. You don't think it came out of Flager's Committee of Coordination to coordinate the response of the agencies to the Bricker Amendment, was headed by Flager, White House.
I'm not sure that they got active that soon.
Well, they were active, they got active early, as early as March that year, and they had about five or six meetings right on through.
It's conceivable that they consulted with Nolan and Ferguson on that. If so, I didn't know about it at the time.
Well, one of the things that the Bricker people say is that the administration adopted a conscious strategy of delay. And I'm not sure, I want to get your reaction on this. I can see where they would think this, that when you go into these conferences, going into the secondary of my question here, your conferences in December and January, there were so many of them. I'm just beginning to get them untangled, what was discussed at each one. And,
of December of 53.
Right,
yeah.
And January.
Well, I think undoubtedly everybody on the administration side hoped if they could delay it, put it over at least for another year, that it would die out. The sentiment for it would die out. I think delay probably was the first.
So you would say there was a deliberate strategy of delay, or
to prevent a vote? Yes.
To prevent a vote. Well, this is the way they regarded it.
I think that's what Taft was trying to do.
Uh huh. There was a very colorful phrase that Chuck Webb, who was Senator Bricker's assistant.
Yeah.
Had in one of his private letters, and describing this later, he said they were negotiations in the Penn Mungiung style. And
well, that had developed later, I think, but I think it was true. See, it was, I think Bricker, Senator Bricker, thought that this would be probably the first important piece of legislation, call it legislation, or the first important product of the Congress in the Eisenhower administration.
Mm-hmm.
As I remember it, it was resolution number one. It was signed by a very large number of senators who were co-sponsoring it. And I think when Eisenhower was elected, they just assumed that this would breeze through. And it could easily have come to a quick vote in the Senate. And if it had, it probably would have passed. So that I'm sure that there was an effort to delay it until the full implications of it could be explained and public opinion aroused and public debate started, bar associations and the law school and things of that sort.
Well, you know, I get from several sources here that President Eisenhower's position was a little bit different even from the cabinet and certainly the State Department and Justice Department personnel below you. I gather that he really did want a compromise agreement.
Oh yes, it was very much on his mind. He realized that if there was a split within the party right at that particular time, as I recall it, a split at that time in the party on foreign affairs would have been very serious, and that he'd like to get this behind him because his, if it could be done, properly,
well,
so that he could get on to the state things that were on his mind.
Yeah, right. Did you feel that in a way sometimes he was leaning on the Justice and State Departments to try to come up with something?
Oh, yes.
Really leaning on, we've got to get this.
Yeah. Time after time, he told me to get it out of the way.
Well, one source said that Eisenhower came into the room at one of these meetings, and one of the groups was there, and he said, "Now you stay here until you come up with something." The words to that effect, you know. And
he felt that it was holding up action on his legislative program. And that until he got it out of the way, he wasn't going to get action on a number of other important matters that he thought were, you know, more important. He thought, I think, that this was a dispute over language that could be settled without compromising on principle. And that it was really a quarrel of lawyers over language.
And he always thought that right on through, didn't he, to a certain extent? Because I know he would never, if you convinced him that this would cut down on executive authority, any given draft that was being studied at the time, would cut down on executive authority, I know he was determined he would not allow that to happen.
That's right.
But other than that, so I suppose, in a way, Flager and Rankin and some of the others who were fighting this in the bureaucracy below had their work cut out for them. If they could convince the president that any given phrase or so forth cut down on executive authority, then they had blocked the president from giving public support.
I think that's right. That's a good analysis.
Well, fine. Because every draft that was put up to him, it seemed like there was always some way that this could be interpreted, in which it would, it would be.
Well, that's true. I mean, you take you ask a layman to read over a 14th Amendment, and how can he possibly get all the implications that are involved there unless he knows the Supreme Court took decisions over a period of 100 years of interpreting it? And he wouldn't get the slightest idea of some of the implications by reading the language.
Yeah.
And that was at the heart of this Bricker debate. You look at some language and it sounded fine. But then if you really dug into it and applied the cases to it, you'd find out that it did decrease executive authority where to a point where he almost went back to the old Confederation days before the Constitution was adopted, where we didn't have any power in the presidency to deal with the foreign affairs.
Well, at the end of January, this is one of the crucial, January and February is really crucial, the heart of the whole thing. Eisenhower appeared to be getting very frustrated with the inability of arriving at any kind of satisfactory compromise. And low peeved at Bricker because Bricker wouldn't accept something he thought he should be able to accept. And so he began working on a nationwide TV address. And that thing went through 11 drafts. I've got copies of each of the 11 drafts. it was worked on, you probably worked on it yourself. The president must have spent hours and hours working on that draft, on those drafts, getting it right for a nationwide TV address, and he was talking in private about if this thing passes, the which clause now, mind you, passes, he's going to give Dulles a leave of absence, Secretary of State, so he can go and testify before the state legislatures to defeat the thing. And then, right at the end, you know, he's getting ready to do this. Right at the end, the whole thing gets shelved, and he doesn't make the address at all. And I don't have any hard facts on why that TV address was shelved. I have some theories, but do you have any facts at all?
My theory would be that he found out he didn't need to do it, that it was going to be defeated.
Well, that's one theory. Now, there's this theory. Nolan had been pressing Ike to come out with a position. I gather Nolan wanted him to take any kind of position for his guidance Eisenhower was just kind of close-mouthed on this. He felt like he was walking in a minefield. And so Ike wrote Nolan this famous letter, January 25th, 1954. I am unalterably opposed to the Bricker Amendment as reported by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Now, I found out yesterday in research at Columbia University, Nolan says he was under the impression that he was authorized to release that letter. However, I have also come across correspondence from Eisenhower to you saying, did I authorize him? I don't recall saying anything about it. I don't know if you recall that memo from Eisenhower or not. Did I say anything did I say anything stupid this morning that might give him the impression that I authorized him to release the letter? I have his memo to you, but I don't have any reply that you sent. So whether the letter was really authorized, Eisenhower wasn't under the impression he was authorizing it.
I don't recall that incident.
Well, he was surprised it was released.
Yeah.
And he said he wouldn't have used Bricker's name if he had known he was going to be released. So you don't recall how that thing got. Well, all right.
No, I don't.
Nolan kept pressing him for a statement of support for one of these other new compromises, leadership compromise for the George Substitute. And I have some very interesting correspondence. Another letter from Nolan. Two drafts of the letter went up to Eisenhower. One of them said, the leadership agreement is all right. I won't object to it. The other draft was the exact opposite, saying that no draft should be accepted without more prolonged study. Two inconsistent letters for the president to sign. And what happened was, he didn't sign either one of them. Now, what I was wondering was, if you could shed any light on how it was that Eisenhower backed off from making any further statement on this, because he was being pressed in all directions to make a further commitment, one way or the other. Right after, in the beginning of February, right when the George Amendment came up.
Well, I can see why the president didn't sign either one. I don't actually remember the incident, but he was being pressed by some of the senators, like Senator George, to stay out of the fight altogether.
Well, that's what George wanted to do, kind of benevolent neutrality. I gather Nolan thought that Eisenhower had agreed not to fight the George Amendment.
Well, I'm sure that there was great pressure on Eisenhower not to fight the George Amendment. That they took the tack there that essentially it didn't involve the treaty power, and that it was a matter that the Senate should decide, and the president probably wasn't a part of the process of submitting a constitutional amendment. And the president obviously didn't want to get into an unnecessary fight with Senator George. And I would think that was the reason that he didn't make any unnecessary statements. He tried to limit his personal participation in the thing as much as possible, and let Dulles and myself and others carry the fight against the amendment.
But he didn't object to you fighting the George Amendment.
No. Senator George did. He would had that
well,
famous press
that,
conference.
I'm that clear attorney general.
Because I had no business mixing in Senate consideration of a constitutional amendment.
I wondered if George said that because he was, felt a little bit, the word is, well, I don't want to use an emotionally loaded word, it's the only one that comes to mind, double-crossed here. But Nolan says there was a misunderstanding in later years. He says in an interview that there obviously was a misunderstanding. I was under the impression that the president would not come out against this. And based upon that, I got Senator Bricker to drop the witch clause and accept the leadership thing. And I checked the votes on it, and he did. Bricker and the Bricker forces abandoned the witch clause. Of course, they might as well have been beaten anyway.
By that time.
So now I was put in this terribly embarrassing situation of saying to Bricker, if you drop the witch clause, we'll go over to the George Amendment, the administration won't oppose it. And then what happens? Eisenhower indicates in some way, although he wouldn't sign that letter that it would have made it public, Eisenhower indicated to them, or they thought he indicated to them, that he was going to stay out of it. And
well,
then,
that could account for George's statement.
Yeah. And then what happens, all the full lobbying effort of the White House hits Capitol Hill to defeat the Georgia
bill. Well, that sounds like a very logical explanation to me, because I never knew that Nolan did that. And I imagine Senator George thought, in effect, what's going on here?
Yeah.
I'm getting two stories. That isn't the way it came out, but I think the way it came out was just a journalistic device have a good story. But Senator George and I always got along very well.
Well, you mean that state, that queer attorney general state?
Yeah, I think that was... I think well, he probably thought of it. I think your analysis is probably right. He thought it was a queer thing that Senator Nolan would come to him reporting to represent the administration viewpoint, and then I'd come to him with the opposite, purporting to represent the administration viewpoint. I think that's probably the correct analysis of his, why he made that statement.
Yeah. But the whole White House lobbying effort did go into it at the last minute to defeat it. And by the way, it was successful. But it also was the reason why Nolan said he decided, in view of the thing, he voted no on the George Amendment the first time it came up. And that's why Brady made his famous speech going back to the back of the Senate. He's saying, I'm voting as a senator, and switched to vote in favor of it because he felt he owed George something.
Yeah.
Having...
Well, throughout there was a lot of senatorial politics involved in this matter of prestige. Senators, it was almost as important as what the Constitution Amendment said. I felt that was always a factor. As I say, Senator Bricker was so well liked that a lot of senators just kind of hated to vote against him, felt they were sort of letting him down because he had dramatized this issue over a period of months.
Well, I've got to like him myself.
Oh,
he is so kind and courteous and courtly. And
really a fine man.
He certainly is. Well, that was the end of it for all practical purposes, but you didn't know it at the time.
No, I think it came up again.
It came up again
in
55, 56.
There never was any real steam in it.
No.
After that.
There wasn't. But you did have conferences with some ABA leaders. Lloyd Wright was... one who came by. And
Frank Holman.
And Frank Holman. Do you recall anything in particular in those later meetings as to why the negotiations broke down? They thought they had worked out something with you too at one time.
Well, they were a series of meetings, but they were language swappers more than anything else, because the danger of anything really passing eventuated. So these negotiations in sort of an unreal atmosphere. Edgar Eisenhower was with Frank Holman and Lloyd Wright. The president was very respectful of the American Bar Association. issues. In fact, that's one thing he never could quite understand, is how they took the position in favor of the First Amendment, and others were pointing out to him that legally and constitutionally it was a bad thing.
Yeah.
And he never could understand how that happened, but he instructed me and to make every effort to try and come to an agreement with the American Bar Association group on a substitute that was workable and satisfactory to represent his point of view. So while we had many meetings, one time we thought we had some language, which really was only a statement that no treaty in violation of the Constitution would, would be
acceptable.
Yeah. And some of the American Bar Association group wanted to take that. I mean, we thought this for a while that Senator Bricker did. And there was quite a reasonable possibility at that time that such an amendment would have been sponsored by Senator Bricker and passed. But he finally came to the conclusion that that was an empty gesture that didn't really accomplish anything.
Well, you think it was because of the split within the Bricker forces, the split within the ABA itself, and
yeah.
whether to accept the half loaf or
yeah,
not, that,
yeah.
That killed that?
Yeah, I do.
That was the impression
yeah.
I got. That if they had been willing to accept a half loaf at that point, even in 55, or even maybe perhaps as, 50, as late as 56,
yeah.
they could have gotten the Bricker amendment.
That is true, in my opinion.
After 56, 57, I doubt. Down to 57 is probably there easy way.
Yeah. 55 or 6 round in there, I think it would have.
Because the prospective votes on the thing was still up to 59, 60 senators in favor.
Yes.
Even that late in the game.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to ask you one question. One of the big issues on the that came, that was in the whole Bricker Amendment thing, was the fight over the status of forces treaty. And of course the Justice Department was involved in the status of forces controversy as it was coming up. Some things I've run across kind of indicate to me there was some difficulty within the administration trying to work out a common administration position on what the status of forces position of the administration should be. Is there anything that you recall that would shed light on that?
I doubt if that's so. I think the president took a position very early, so stated in a cabinet meeting that he favored this and he wanted everybody to favor it. It was a very important issue as far as he was concerned in his administration measure, and he wanted it passed. And I don't recall any different opinion within the administration about it. His president's leadership on that was very forceful. There was no organized opposition in the Congress. It was serious. And I think for all those reasons that it went through rather smoothly, there was some extremist opposition to it, that he couldn't force an American citizen to be. There were some countries where they were, under their judicial system, they cut off their arms or their legs or things of that sort. It was kind of a, it really was an extremist position. And but except for that type of opposition, it went very smoothly.
Yes. Bricker Reservation was defeated handsomely
yeah.
in May of 1953, even by some of the senators who later voted for the Bricker Amendments, voting against the reservation. But I came across some interesting correspondence to the effect that in the Defense Department, some of the lawyers over there said, now, wait a minute, maybe we are giving away too much, because under previous precedents, we did have complete criminal jurisdiction on troops. And now under this agreement that's coming up, we are agreeing to turn over some jurisdiction that we in the past we haven't had to do.
Yeah. I think there was some. I think you're correct on that. But it was brushed aside. It never gained any significant support within the administration.
That was within the Defense Department.
Yeah.
The Defense Department didn't adopt that position officially.
No, they did not. Yes. Quite the contrary.
But that clears that up.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, one other...
I don't think there would have been any opposition to the status of forces agreement if it hadn't been the Brick Amendment. The controversy was very hot at that time.
Hmm.
And so I can see that the Brick forces might have used that as another way of calling attention to the importance of the Brick Amendment. Except for that, I think it was very smooth sailing for it. And it was something that the President had his heart set on. He was really determined on that. He initiated that, whereas the Bricker Amendment was already in the works and people had all taken sides before he was ever inaugurated. But that's one of the things that made it so hard for him to handle. It wasn't something that he had initiated. Part of his administration program. It was a fight that everybody had taken sides on before he was inaugurated.
One little thing that maybe not as important as some things we're discussing, but in looking through the Justice Department papers, I was very much interested in seeing the correspondence that you had with Walter White of the NAACP, in which he had writing the senators to get their position. He was passing on information to you. And it occurred to me when I was looking at that was a very effective way of mobilizing some lobbies, mobilizing a segment of public opinion. And really, that's, when you come down to it, that's what he did.
Well, that's the way I felt, that was our best chance of defeating it. And we used, push Corwin and Professor Griswold and the New York City Bar Association was a group to that kind.
I know Flager and State Department stayed almost in constant touch with the Committee to Defend the Constitution.
Yes.
And coordinated the efforts and so forth.
That's true.
And I wondered, with Flager and some administration people working so closely with the group that was out to defeat it, if Eisenhower, if he knew that much about what was going on down there, or if he was a little peeved because he was trying to get an amendment, trying to get something satisfactory, satisfactory compromise, and here this group, however, took position, no amendment at all, no compromise whatsoever, just leave it, we're better off as it, without anything, which of course we were.
Yeah. Well, I think you may have a point there. I think, I know the President felt that there was a weakness in having the State Department represent him in this fight, because first the Dulles speech that he made in Louisville during the campaign, and which led the Brick forces to think that he would support them throughout, and perhaps an intransigent opposition to any Bricker amendment, whereas he did want to compromise, get it out of the way. And that's why I think he brought the Justice Department more into the negotiations with the American Bar.
Well, in retrospect, would you say there was a difference in, say, Eisenhower's personal position and your personal position? Of course, I know you loyally supported him. There's complete evidence of that. But your own personal outlook on the thing really was closer to no amendment at all than his was.
That is correct. Yeah, we would have. We carried on the negotiations at his direction, trying to get a satisfactory compromise. We would have been very happy to have it voted down, and get it over with.
But you did make a good faith effort to
follow
the president's directions in that.
We explored every angle we could think of to get a compromise.
As far as you know, Eisenhower did not perceive that any of his own people were working against what he was trying to do.
I think the answer to that probably is that he felt that his, that we were a better negotiating team, so we put it for a compromise on the State Department.
I see.
So to that extent, you might say that he felt that if there was any chance for a compromise at all, which he wanted, that we could do it for him.
Yeah. Well, I know when Bricker walked into any of these conferences and Blager was there, he just figured, well, this isn't serious at all.
Yeah.
But when he walked in with you, you both have such high regards for for each other.
We really tried.
Bricker spoke in highly of you today, and this is a very interesting thing.
Well,
and he can't stand Dulles, though.
Yeah.
He really can't. He thought he
well, I think Dulles. I think he felt that Dulles had really let him down, because I think he felt that Louisville speech was a speech in favor of the Bricker Amendment.
You know, you mentioned the Louisville speech. I suppose pages of ink has been written about that Louisville speech.
I'm sure of it.
When you come right down to it, it wasn't Dulles playing politics. It wasn't a campaign address in 1952.
Yeah.
I really, how much did he really believe what he was saying about
his life? Well, at that time, his central effort was to be on good terms with everybody in the Republican Party, regardless of who was going to be nominated.
Sure.
He didn't know whether Taft was going to be nominated or Eisenhower was going to be nominated. And he was being asked by both sides to write a platform on foreign affairs that could be adopted without a big war fight. And that was his whole effort at that time, was to smooth over controversies within the party so that there wouldn't be a big row at the convention. I'm sure that was.
So he wrote a speech in which he spoke on both sides of the issue, knowing he was speaking on both sides of the issue, but trying not to contradict himself, but actually ending up doing that.
I think that's a good explanation. And it was very fruitful. You have to give it credit for it, because it did avoid it. Not that one speech, but his whole effort did avoid a big row at the 52 convention between the Eisenhower forces and the Taft forces over matter that was tremendous importance to Eisenhower. He would have turned down the nomination if there had been an isolation of Frank and the Republican platform, because that's the only reason he was running for president, was to prevent the party from taking an isolation point of view in foreign affairs.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing that I'm convinced caused him to run in the first place. And he was certainly very strong with me at all points. There was an isolationist claim to the platform. Count him out. Even if he had to say it after he was nominated, he would have turned down the nomination. And he felt that was his mission. And otherwise, there was no point in his running for president. He had all the honors that there were in the world. And Dulles deserves a lot of credit, I think, for presenting a platform that could be accepted from all sides. And, of course, all it did was further fight until the Bricker Amendment came along.
Yeah.
And that was the first real test. There were other tests, too, like Poland, confirmation, things of that sort. And the party was split, blinking that.
Well, if I recall the Taft, the Boland thing, Taft said, went to the wire with the president on that, finally got that one through, and he said to Dulles afterwards, he said, "No, don't ever do that again."
I think that's right. people lived with a different controversy with them. I think he would have accomplished what the president wanted to accomplish. Get it out of the way, get on with the legislative program.
I don't think Taft could have followed the same strategy in 54 that he did in 53. 53 he was delayed.
Yeah.
But in 54, they had too many supporters. They would have had to bring it to the floor. And we know probably.
Traces of communist bureaucracy in our own government, and that the and the Brick Amendment was used more or less as a standard around which people felt that way to rally. And there was no, and that group did not consciously want to take away from the president his leadership in foreign affairs.
Mm-hmm.
That was the reason that the president, I think, felt that there was a possibility of compromise. It was kind of an emotional reaction against the New Deal or something of that sort, and the Republicans were now in power, and they began to show him that he was different than the philosophy of that time. But it was not a carefully thought out position.
Mm-hmm.
And when that group came to realize what the consequences were of passing the Brick Amendment, they dropped away from it. That, I think, is the real way to analyze this thing and understand the motives of the president and to understand the decreasing support for the Brick Amendment.
And there's one memo that President Eisenhower wrote you in 1955, I believe, saying, I don't know if you recall this or not, I get this in the Eisenhower papers. There's a reason I want the Brick Amendment that we haven't discussed before. And that is, I'm afraid that if I am succeeded by a politically weak administration, they might succeed in putting through an amendment that would be very, very bad indeed.
I do remember that. I don't reason to feel that way. One of the reasons they couldn't come to the right conclusion was that people didn't understand the significance of it. It was superficially, it was going to be obvious that we should adopt the Brick Amendment. It was only when you studied it that you found out why you couldn't. And still keep a strong federal government in foreign affairs.
You know, there is, even among moderates and liberals today, a slight shift of opinion beginning in the 70s. Looking back on this, that I'm beginning to detect it. I think it's just getting underway. Before the 70s, the standard liberal opinion on the Brick Amendment was just, against it.
Yeah.
Defeat of isolationism and so forth. But I think the Vietnam War soured so many.
You're absolutely right.
It's coloring perceptions on things all across the board. And I wrote Fulbright, just out of curiosity. Fulbright was one of those who stood against the Brick Amendment. And I said, what is your position today? Would you vote for the Brick Amendment if it came up again today? And I went through it section by section. Section 1 is no longer needed. That's obsolete. Section 2 is obsolete. What about Section 3? Congress has the right to regulate all executive branches.
How do you feel about that today?
And he wrote back a very interesting letter, a three-page letter, in which he said that today he's favored.
Doesn't surprise me. Almost any variation of the George Amendment, certainly, maybe even the Brick Amendment, could have passed the Congress a couple of years ago at the end of the Vietnam War. The fact that you passed the Chavez, for example, passed that legislation, which said that it would very drastically restricted the power of the president to introduce armed forces into any other country. Shows the George Amendment would have passed in a breeze at the end of the Vietnam War. So these things go in cycles. And I think most of the reason it would have passed a couple of years ago is that the sentiment was that we'd have another Vietnam War unless Congress flipped the wings of the president.
said that he didn't impute any greater wisdom to the Congress than the President, but that matters of importance of relations with the rest of the world, he thought it was important that both should arrive at an independent position, that the country was safer when both took a stand. And that's why he would have Congress regulate in some way executive agreements.
Well, I think myself that's wrong, probably. I think that unless the President has the power to make the executive agreements, that there is no way of working with Congress, because Congress has got the power of the first and so forth. And if the President doesn't have the power to make the executive agreements and initiate the treaties, then we're right back where we were under the old Articles of Confederation. That's what they thought then, and it didn't work, and that's the reason we had the Constitution and gave these powers to the executive. And I think the Javits legislation is a great mistake, and if it ever comes to a point where it'll come to the front and be really tested, any strong executive is going to disregard it, and you just cannot operate foreign affairs. You're going to have committee rule, if you're going to have congressional rule. We tried it in our early days and it didn't work.
Well, of course, some people think that what will happen is that in a way, this might even strengthen the President more. Because when you have an emergency situation, the President goes to Congress and the Congress says, I need authorization, he's almost bound to get it. If the country is in the House of with that kind of authorization, why you don't need such resolutions like Gulf of Tonkin, and you have it built in there. And,
I don't have to agree with that.
Of course, it hasn't been tested yet.
Yeah.
They think it'll actually work out.
Yeah.
They won't do what the proponents of the legislation think it will do. It won't really serve as any kind of check because the President is the one that has to make these decisions.
Yeah. Well, I think that's right, and one way or another, he'll do it.
Yeah.
In fact, if he has to defy it, he'll do it in the name of emergency.
Blackboard,
if he's supported. Yeah, so it is unrealistic. So when you say that the Brick Amendment or the George Amendment might have been adopted at the end of the Vietnam War, maybe it's not true. I think they would still hesitate to put it in the Constitution, but I think this was a very good to demonstrate congressional strength. And as you point out, it will not, when the showdown comes, be very effective.
Well, I don't want to take any more of your time.
Oh, well, this is
thank you very much. End of interview.